Fear not, Joseph. My name is Moroni. I am a messenger sent from the presence of God. God has a work for you to do, Joseph. Not far from here, there is a book, hidden in the earth, written upon plates of gold. It is a record that gives an account of my people, a people who lived here in the Americas over 2,000 years ago. This holy record was compiled anciently by my own father, and you are to call the record after my father's name, the Book of Mormon.
Good evening, and welcome to another episode of Mormon Expression. I'll be your host tonight, Glenn Ostlund, and I'm joined by several familiars and one new guest with us. So let's start around the table. Randy Snyder.
Good evening, everyone.
How are you, Randy? And Bob Coswell.
Hey there. Good to be here. It's Caswell, but that's cool.
I do that every time. I've done this before. I like Coswell. Sorry.
No worries.
What can I say? And then we've got Matt Long.
Hey, everybody.
And then joining us, a friend of yours, Matt, Patrick.
Guard.
Patrick Guard.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I guess I'm non-familiar.
Non-Mormon, non-familiar on Mormon Expression. Tonight we are talking about a movie that was released, 2003, called The Book of Mormon. Movie was volume one, and what was the extended title with it?
The Journey.
Yeah, The Journey. Yeah. And Matt and Patrick are involved in another podcast called Lunchtime Movie Review. Matt, why don't you talk a little bit about that? And that's going to be the format that we follow to review the Book of Mormon movie tonight.
Well, basically, we are children of the 80s, and so we review films from our childhood and see whether or not they stand the test of time. Spoiler alert, usually they don't.
All right.
Except for Footloose, which absolutely was a piece of pile of crap.
Oh, then and now?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, so I guess we'll see if the Book of Mormon movie stands the test of time.
I'm on pins and needles, just wondering if it does or not.
So I'm going to step back and let Matt take this over and do it in lunchtime movie review style. So take it away, man.
All right. Awesome. Well, we've been very fortunate on every movie that we review. We try to find a new sponsor or a new advertiser, and we've been pretty successful in the past. And so in a similar fashion, I went out and tried to find someone who would sponsor this podcast, and I was able to get one.
Great.
So this podcast is brought to you by Kimball Skin Whitener. Right. Do you tan a little too easy? Do you have just a little bit too much pigmentation? Try Kimball's Skin Whitener. That is all.
Whitener lights him.
Nice.
We're very excited. Yeah, didn't know he was putting his name to that.
Yeah. Wait, Matt, would you say that this skin lightener would make you more enticing to others?
Well, yeah, I would say you certainly are a little more delightsome. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
All right. So,
and while none of the actors used the skin whitener, there was a lot of teeth whitening going on, I think. In the,
yeah, and skin darkening.
Skin darkening, teeth
whitening.
They
went the other direction, which is kind of weird.
Cool.
They did. That was the costumes and makeup, I think. But, well, usually we also do a brief summary of the film, but that's not really necessary here. But Glenn, did you want to talk about real quick basically what the volume one covers from the Book of Mormon?
Yeah, well, I mean, it starts with Nephi being born of goodly parents, and right up, I think it's about the first 66 pages of the Book of Mormon. It's right after the Nephites separate from the Lamanites. The Lamanites have gone through their skin change, and they're now not recognized, and they're getting ready to go to war, or the Nephites are ready to receive the Lamanite war parties, or that's about where it ends.
Right. So primarily, most of it is kind of in Jerusalem. You've got a real brief part in the Promised Land, and then right the various groups separate, and that's kind of right. You said that I think it was the first 66 pages. They said of the.
So it's the journey from the old world to the new world.
Okay, so being the only heathen, you're telling me this is only 66 pages of the book?
Yeah.
So, I mean, typically in a script, it's a minute per page. This should have been 66 minutes long, and they dragged this out for 2 hours or 2 hours and 30 minutes is what the original cut was.
Yeah.
Well, and about 20% of that 66 pages is, and it came to pass. So you got to really account for that too. It's more like 45 pages.
Well, this if people don't know, this film was actually released in the theater. So they were charging back in 2003, 2004, the same as they were for other movies at the time. But Patrick, you did a little research on this when this came out, right?
Yeah, it was released on September 12th of 2003. It was released the same day as Cabin Fever, Matchstick Men, and Once Upon a Time in Mexico. Oh, and Lost in Translation also came out on that day. Same month as Dickie Roberts, former child star, Underworld, Anything Else, The Fighting Temptations, and The Rundown. It grossed just short of $1.7 million. Depending on where you read the figures, it either cost $1.5 million to make or $2 million to make. It was the 196th highest grossing film that year, which...
Out of how many?
Which actually was surprising. There were 506 movies released in 2003. So it actually was in the top half.
Wow.
It was the 41st highest film on its opening weekend. So not even getting a lot of press or a lot of coverage during that time, but it did run for about 9 months. I can give you the list of movies that it finished behind as far as money for that year, but you probably don't know any of them. It's Calho No 2, The Legend of Johnny Lingo, movies I've never heard of, and I see.
Whoa,
every...
whoa, whoa.
That... Wait.
Johnny Lingo?
What?
The Legend of Johnny Lingo is also a Mormon film, Patrick.
Oh, is it? That's why I haven't heard of it. Did not get a lot of play outside of Utah.
Well, was this released outside of Utah? I mean, what was the coverage? Was it a nationwide release, or did it have a limited distribution?
It only played on, I think, at its – Matt and I were talking about this ahead of time – about 34, 39 screens at its biggest release. It was primarily centered in Utah. There was a little bit of coverage in Arizona. I went and actually looked at some of the critics' reviews of it, only reviewed by six critics, two of them from Arizona, the rest from all from Utah. So I don't think it got a lot of coverage on the East Coast or probably even the Midwest.
Yeah, well, I guess a few screens in Arizona, a few screens in Idaho, a few screens in California, maybe, and then obviously Utah.
Well, I lived in Jacksonville, Florida when it was released, and I was out of town for the weekend for a USC football game. But my wife and her parents went to a screening at the local theater at Jacksonville, and the guy who played Nephi was there, Noah something, what's his name, the actor
Danby, Noah
yeah.
Danby.
Noah Danby.
I call him Noah dang good looking. That's all you need to know.
Yeah, he's a handsome man. Anyway, he was there at the screening, and after just before they started the movie, they had him stand up and take questions, and people were asking if he felt the spirit when he did the movie, and he said that he had taken a couple of discussions, nothing's been decided yet, but he definitely felt something during the filming of this movie. I think he was pandering to the crowd.
Right. It was a paycheck and he was the lead for once. But
and did he join eventually, Randy?
Absolutely not.
No, he did not. Okay.
Well, and Patrick had found an interesting fact on him, who he's at least currently married to.
Well, he dated the actress who played his wife in the film during production, but he ended up marrying Christina Loken, who is actually the Terminator, the evil Terminator in Terminator 3. So it was
nice.
But they're currently separated, so it doesn't seem working out for her.
She's available.
Yeah, maybe she's hurting.
All right. No.
so that's kind of what it did, right? But who was it made by? Does anyone know who was behind? Kind of the driving horse behind Volume 1, The Journey?
Gary Rogers.
Gary Rogers is the writer, director, and producer, which is why there's one person to blame. It's Gary Rogers.
And Gary Rogers literally has done nothing in film before this, right?
No. He's done nothing in film before this, nothing in film since this.
And very little during. And he he was inspired by Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments. You know, he saw that when he was a kid, and so he had this dream for 50 years that he wanted to do the same thing for Mormon cinema.
He should have done that instead.
Yeah, right.
I'm so sorry for him. When I see him and the extras being interviewed, you could see that he just had such a passion and a love for this project. This was a total labor of love, but he was so out of his depth.
Well, it was a missionary effort, really. I mean, he was trying to get the message of the Book of Mormon out, and because it was made for a non-Mormon audience, wasn't it?
Sort of.
Yeah, it was at least designed to. I think just that it was a missionary tool to try to promote the Book of Mormon. It says right at the very beginning, it's very interesting. You know, they say this is a historical. you know, this is history. This is an actual event, essentially.
The story you are about to see is based on actual events which occurred in the Book of Mormon. Because the events depicted span a great period of time, certain creative liberties have been taken in order to make this film. Viewers familiar with the Book of Mormon will find that many events could not be included. However, the exact and complete account can be found in the record itself, the Book of Mormon.
In the opening scenes, it recreates the Joseph Smith story, him seeing Moroni in his room, and Moroni repeats Moroni's promise at the end of the Book of Mormon. He says, anyone who prays about this will get an answer. So, I mean, that's kind of how they frame the whole thing.
Is it too simplistic to call this a metaphor for good old active Mormons everywhere? You know, the whole world sort of pans this movie as the worst movie ever and doesn't believe in it being what it purports to be and really isn't behind it in any way whatsoever. And the guy who made it is probably crushed, the guy who believed in it, the guy who was a part of it through the whole thing and has his reputation on the line. I don't know, it just sounds kind of familiar. I've heard this narrative before.
Right. The problem is that it was panned by it was not only panned by everyone, it was panned by Mormons, and Mormons didn't even embrace the film.
Right, which makes it doubly as bad. I mean, that's like having a good testimony, and you go up to the pulpit and you bear your testimony, and then afterwards somebody's like, "Did that miracle really happen? I mean, come on." And you're like, "What? That was my testimony. You're not allowed to do that." It just feels like this guy's got to be crushed. I don't know where he is or what happened to him, but this is pretty bad stuff for a Mormon.
Well, they were planning on making several versions. I mean, this was volume one, and they were supposed to – did anybody get a number how many they were supposed to be?
Sometimes six, sometimes nine, depending on the source you're talking to.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that is very ambitious to say, I am making the Book of Mormon volume one, saying it's they're coming. And I think it does show – this guy is you hit it right. He is a fan of Mormonism, fan of the Book of Mormon. He loves the Book of Mormon and he loves the source material. And it really was a labor of love for him. But – sorry, I lost my train of thought. But he and so it was ambitious for him to say, okay, I'm going to make nine of these suckers. But I really think it was – this thought of, if I make the Book of Mormon the ultimate story that supports kind of our people and our religion, you know, kind of if I build it, they will come. And he was sure that at least Mormons were going to go in droves, and he was going to get, you know, many, many millions of viewers paying money to see this.
Well, I think go ahead.
So, well, I find it interesting as probably the only non-Mormon here. One, I have issue with Bob saying this is the worst film of all time. My friend, you have not seen The Brown Bunny. You see The Brown Bunny, you think this is a piece of art compared to that. But more importantly, going back to the original point, was that, you know, not knowing or being familiar with the Book of Mormon, this film, you know, is the idea that it was supposed to bring non-Mormons in, you know, you need to appeal to your base. You need to satisfy your own your own audience, and when you alienate them, when you change it enough that they don't feel that it captures the essence of what it's about, especially religious belief, that you're not going to draw people in, because when people come in or possibly start, you know, researching or exploring the Book of Mormon themselves, and it's not what this film detailed, a bad film, by the way, badly acted, badly produced, people are going to be betrayed with that. And it's interesting that during my research to hear that people in the Mormon religion did not embrace this film. And that I found very shocking, that, you know, this is supposed to be then. But I don't know why. It doesn't go into detail why they do. And so I'm curious what you guys have to say. Why wasn't this embraced by the Mormon religion?
It's embarrassing.
That's
just
accurate.
So bad, or
because or so the, yeah, the production values are so bad. I can't imagine anybody who would want to stand by this and say, yes, this is me, this is my people, this is my
right.
culture.
It may not be the worst film, I'll concede that point, but it's the worst film any good Mormon has seen. Probably.
That's a limited amount of movies that you can see.
Right. PG-13 or less.
That's right.
Which does bring an interesting point about the rating. It initially did get a PG-13 rating.
Yeah, for that one scene with blood, heaven forbid. You chop somebody's head off and you spray blood on the person who has the sword, and you release it to the theater that way, and you're going to get a PG-13 rating. But they changed it for the DVD and toned it down because, you know, God forbid the Mormon message gets out to the world out there with some blood splatter and a PG-13 rating.
Patrick, I think one of the reasons that it's embarrassing to Mormons and that it is as bad a movie as it is, because they took everything so literal, and, you know, even quoting passages from the Book of Mormon very seriously, very dry. They didn't really take liberties to try and develop real characters, because he just was on this narrow track that he didn't want to stray from. And so it kind of brings out how ridiculous some of these storylines are.
Okay, but so actually,
I was going to say, Patrick, I'll just give you my reaction, because at the time this was released, 2003, I was a hardcore devout believer. And my reaction to it, I remember very clearly, was because, you know, what you don't understand if you're not Mormon is that you think that the Book of Mormon is the greatest book ever written. Okay. So if someone's going to have the audacity to take on a project to represent to the world in drama form what the Book of Mormon is, the greatest book ever written, it better be damn good. And this sucked. And I was like, this is such a great book, and this guy messed it up. And so that's why I think a lot of Mormons were embarrassed, because they're like, yeah, the Book of Mormon is so much better. But in reality, the story is not that good.
and that's what I think is funny. You say, well, he screwed it up, but he only presented the source material.
Yeah.
I mean, that was his, to me, was his problem, or the flaw of the film, is that he didn't go deeper into the characters by way of motivation, by way of fleshing out, you know, backstories or other things to provide context. These are two-dimensional characters in the Book of Mormon, and then when you splash it up on the screen, they even become less deep, right?
Well, it tried to place these stories into a real-world context, and it exposed some of the real silliness of these stories, and I'll give you one example of that. There's this series of scenes where Lehi's children go back to Jerusalem to get the plates of brass from Laban, and first Laman is sent, and Laman goes, and he just tries to reason with Laban. He's chased off. The next day, all of these brothers go back together, but because we're looking at this visually, now there's a problem that you don't really think about when you're reading it. You're like, Laban already has seen Laman. He knows what he looks like. And he's tried to chase him off and kill him. What's he going to do when he comes back with all of the gold and says, oh, now we want to buy them? So the filmmakers try to address that by having all of them cover their faces. And it just looks—it looks absolutely ridiculous. And they're talking to each other like, "Oh, this is a great plan. I hope this works." And they walk in there and they're talking to Laban with their faces covered, and he says, "Uncover your faces so I can see who I'm talking to." And they're like deers in the headlight. like, oh, they hadn't thought that maybe he would ask him to uncover their faces. And it's just – it's absolutely ridiculous. And then he sees who they are, and they start running from the guards again.
Right. Along the same lines, that scene or those scenes where they're going back to get the plates, it highlighted for me the ineptitude of God, because it talks about God having a plan and I will go and do the things which the Lord hath commanded. And he quotes that over and over again. But then it really feels like they're just on their own. They're just figuring stuff up as they go. There is no plan. They aren't really given help until, you know, the very end. But all the stuff leading up to that, it came off almost like a Keystone Cop, or like, you know, it was just almost just comedy with how things didn't work out. And it was highlighted when you see it visually.
Yeah, and I'd take it one step further and point out that Nephi just comes across as a dickhead, because let me back it up. I mean, people are having very human reactions to the way God is fumbling this situation. I mean,
what?
they spend like 30 to 40 minutes, you know, in the beginning of the movie just getting out of Jerusalem, and they keep going back and forth. We have a plan. No, we don't. We have a plan. And it just doesn't work out, for, you know, three times in a row. And Laman and Lemuel are kind of calling God on his bluff, or whatever you want to call it, being like, this is the dumbest way to go about this. Why, you know, why are we going back and forth in and out of the city so many times? And then the movie even self, you know, references how bad of a plan this is, and how it almost parodies itself with how poorly constructed God thought this through. And it's like almost an inside Mormon joke when they reference it. And it's really kind of uncomfortable for a believing Mormon. At least I remember watching the movie like, that's funny because God doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, you got to explain now what this self-reference is.
Well, so, oh gosh.
They're getting ready to go back to get the daughters of Ishmael. Well, they've already been back and done the three times a charm. We got the brass plates finally. And this time, after Lehi's told them to go, Nephi goes, hey, why don't you ask the Lord if there's anything else he wants us to do while we're there? Yeah. And they all laugh.
He has protected us and provided us with the plates of brass. However, before we depart this valley, the Lord has commanded that you, my sons, must once again return to Jerusalem.
What? Return to Jerusalem?
Why, Father? What could there possibly be in Jerusalem now?
The Lord has made it known to me that once we possess the promised land, we are to multiply into a mighty people. And I don't know how that can be accomplished without wives for my sons and husbands for my daughters. My friend and colleague Ishmael has sufficient daughters for my sons and sons for my daughters.
Leah.
Yes.
Leah.
Yes.
Father, I think this is the best vision you ever had. Father, I will go and do the things the Lord hath commanded, for I know the Lord would not give a commandment.
Enough, Nephi, enough. Do I know it a little more enthusiasm this time?
Perhaps, Father, perhaps. Oh, one more thing, Father. A favor.
What?
Before we leave tomorrow, would you inquire of the Lord if there is anything else he would have us do while we are in Jerusalem?
Anything. Amen to that.
Yeah.
And they all laugh.
They all laugh, and it's funny, but in a weird kind of like...
Yeah, but see, I mean, and here's the TBM answer to that, though, for those of you who are criticizing God, is that...
My bad, sorry.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, you don't know what his purposes are. You don't know that there's something in these journeys that he's sending them to do that they need to find out about themselves. And this is highlighted when Nephi gets tied up and, you know, the sons of Ishmael and his brothers leave him in the dust. And there's this ridiculous scene. I mean, I'd be interested to get your take on it, Patrick, but he's struggling against these bands, and it shows these like multiple cut shots, probably 8 to 10 different shots of him struggling. And then finally he stops and he prays to the Lord to help him. And then the bands are loose and he just, you know, moves his hands. And it's completely anticlimactic. But the point that the movie makers are trying to get across is that when you're struggling on your own, you're nothing. But as soon as you ask God, it's easy. Which doesn't make for very interesting viewing. in a movie, but it's part of that missionary message that's trying to get across. And so when you talk about the ineptitude of God, you know, God was trying to teach them those lessons.
But nobody learned anything, right? Nephi stayed the same, as did his brothers. Like, for all the lessons that God is teaching, the characters stay the same as they were when they were initially presented to us. So good on you, God.
You're missing the point. This story is for our generation, remember? We're to learn from their experiences.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, what is the Mormon idea of answering prayers? Do it on your own. Or God wants you to do things on your own, figure things out on yourself, you know, by yourself, use your brain. Then he will help you out, you know, in those key moments. I mean, isn't that kind of the Mormon paradigm?
Yeah,
no, it is. And I think that's the message that people talk about in like Sunday school and whatnot. And it's just not, it didn't come across in the film that was the point. And I think that's the flaw. One of the flaws of the film is there's no direction. There's no arc. There's no theme of saying, here's what I want to focus on. Right. I want it to be this. I want character development or to show, I don't know what you'd focus on. If I was the storyteller, if I'd do it from maybe layman's perspective, and that might be a more compelling, kind of interesting one, kind of like Jesus Christ Superstar, right? From it's told the main character is Judas, and so you maybe flesh it out that way to show his motivation and why somebody who sees all these things and experiences all these things still will reject God and things that are true and are good. But he doesn't really do that very well. It's just this awkward, you know, these awkward little scenes of Laman and Lemuel being kind of dicks, and their answer is always to tie up Nephi, tie him up. And then he gets tied up, and then they tie him up, and they tie him up like three or four different times.
That's what happened in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, I know, but again, when it's in film, it seems really weird. And I don't know, Patrick, did you notice that? I mean, we know the story. As you were watching these interactions with the brothers, what were your thoughts?
Well, there was a lot of things. I going kind of to continue your thought there, that there needed to be kind of character development or an arc. That, you know, granted, I do not know the Book of Mormon, but I always thought they lost an opportunity if they were just doing something for entertainment's sake, that Nephi has this kind of this contradiction. God has a purpose for him, and he has to fulfill that purpose, but his brothers are kind of holding him back, but he has this love for his brothers. They could have shown some kind of, you know, this kind of internal strife. What do I need to do to, you know, to kind of convince them? They're pulling me this way. God is pulling me this way. That you could have shown that kind of that dilemma for him and given him some sort of character development. Instead, he's just kind of like, this is what they tell me and you guys need to do it. And, you know, he's kind of like the hall monitor for all intents and purposes for his brothers. And it's like, I want to kick his ass too if I was his brother.
Exactly. Hey, he's a dickhead.
We're stranded out in the middle of the ocean because of you, you shithead. So why, why that kind of stuff, I don't relate to the character, you know, and I'm looking at this strictly as a movie point of view, that, you know, I can understand why his brothers feel the way they do, because even though all the things that he does, how he shows him God or shows him God's power and tries to convince them to change their ways, is that he's always taking them to the extreme. And as a real person, I could probably relate to the brothers better than I can to Nephi.
But that right. highlights, you know, what you're talking about would require the director to take extreme liberties with the source material. And I think this goes back to the reason why Mormons are so uncomfortable with this movie. It's not just that it's bad, but it highlights just how bad a narrative. If you just take the book and throw it up on the screen, all of a sudden you realize this is a shitty book. It's not just
the story sucks.
Yeah, it's just
the characters are yeah. It's you know you talk about Nephi never being any different through all these experiences. He is always the same. You're exactly right, Bob. Is that from the beginning he's Mr. Stalwart and will always do what's right, and at the end he's still there. And I think that makes for a very uninteresting character in an uninteresting movie. We like our heroes somewhat flawed or angst filled. You know, the Spider-Man and the Batman characters, you know, and take any character really, and you don't have that with Nephi, And so there's no reason to like him, and there's no real reason to root for him other than we're going to set up this black and white dichotomy. He's good, everyone else is bad, and that's why you should root for him. And it's just not fulfilling.
And I think it's a different way of presenting a hero. And are you going to present a flawed hero that you can relate to, or are you going to present a hero that represents an ideal? And the ideal that we have here is somebody who is always obedient, you know, always constant. You know, I mean, just like this Nephi stalwart, valiant thing. And I would imagine that if we were having this discussion in any elders' quorum in any church, you know, around the country, there would be a handful of people that would say that they totally do relate to Nephi. Not because they actually do, but because they know that they should.
Right.
And you know, so that this is the ideal that they should measure up to. And I felt like that was kind of what Gary Rogers was a little more interested in, was showing us what should be instead of what actually was. And, you know, so you get people who more are able to empathize with the Laman and Lemuels of the world and go, yeah, this doesn't make sense to me either. Because they kept saying, this doesn't make any sense. This doesn't make any sense. And, you know, you're sitting there watching this movie going, yeah. It really does.
Actually, the actor who played Sam is a pretty familiar face to Mormon cinema. Is Kirby Hayborn? Is that his name?
Yeah.
Yep.
He in the extras in the interview said, "I'm playing the guy that probably most people will relate to. Nobody's as righteous as Nephi. Nobody's as evil as Laman. I'm the normal guy." And I mean, that right there, the actor in the movie showed the ridiculous dichotomy that is portrayed in the book and in the movie.
Or it could be an actor trying to prove his point that my role is very important. I have the fourth lead, but I'm the star.
Well, let's talk about the one scene where there's an opportunity for some angst with Nephi, and that's the Laban killing scene and kind of how they did it different. That's the one time they do kind of depart from the source material.
Behold, Nephi. Thou hast been faithful. The Lord has delivered Laban into thy hands. Slay him.
I cannot kill him. I have never shed the blood of another man. What is this thing you ask of me? Is not the word of God written, thou shalt not kill?
Behold, the Lord slayeth the wicked, to bring forth his righteous purposes. It is better that one man should perish than that a nation should dwindle and perish in unbelief. Slay him, Nephi. Slay him. I command thee in the name of the Lord God, slay him.
Okay, what's the original source material, since all I have is the film version?
Randy, you want to take that?
Okay. Well, in the book, I guess I'll start with the Book of Mormon. He goes back into the city. He kind of sneaks in at night, and then he stumbles. He doesn't know what he's doing because he's going to go and do what the Lord commands, because he knows the Lord will provide a way. First, you know, commandments to be accomplished. First Nephi chapter 3 verse 7. Of course, the Lord delivers him Laban. Drunk, passed out. The guy's unconscious. He's completely unconscious. And then Nephi hears the voice of the Lord saying, kill him.
And Nephi doesn't even recognize him at first, right? He then kind of goes, oh, this is Laban.
Yeah. I don't remember that in the book. I just remember Nephi saying, I have never killed a man before. And that's when the Lord says, it's better for one man to perish than a nation to dwindle and perish in unbelief. And so against his better judgment, because Nephi is a moral person, his immoral God tells him to cut a defenseless man's head off. And so he cuts his head off. And every time this scene is brought up in Sunday school, somebody says, "Don't you wonder where all the blood went?" And so in the movie, they actually did something clever. He took the clothes off first, and then he cut Laban's head off.
Yeah, right.
That was I thought that was the one moment of brilliance by the movie makers. He took the damn clothes off before he cut his head off.
Well, so it would be soaked in blood.
Yeah.
Right, right. In the movie, Patrick, they changed it where, you remember, Laban was not unconscious. He was drunk, and he turns, you know, Nephi, like, turns around, and boom, Laban's in his face. I know you.
With a knife.
With a knife, yeah. And then he goes after him with a knife, and but he's too drunk, and Nephi easily parries the, you know, the blow. And then that's when the whole scene starts where, you know, God tells him to kill him. So the movie made it look more like self-defense, when in reality, in the book, I mean, the guy is completely unconscious and defenseless.
So I'm interested, Patrick, what your take was in the protagonist having that type of a moment and killing a defenseless guy, kind of what your reaction to was.
Well, I was kind of taken back by it because, you know, obviously Nephi is the hero of the piece. The hero usually kills only when he's forced to or he's has to protect himself, protect someone else. I mean, that's, you know, movie-making storytelling 101. Here, he just kills an unconscious man. I was like, whoa, did he really just do that? That just cut off that guy's head. He's drunk. He's drunk. He could have gotten his stuff, what he wanted to get. But no, he's going to, okay, he killed that guy, you know. And it was interesting to see that in a religious film because, usually, religious films are all about morality. And I said, he just killed, you know, murdered. He murdered someone in cold blood. And I know God was telling him to do it, but I was wondering if you know, not being once again familiar with the Book of Mormon, if the God was testing him, if he was going to stick to the moral beliefs, I'm not going to kill this innocent man. No, he's going to do it. Okay, all right, it's, you know, and
he did it.
All right, I guess God's okay with that. So,
well, my problem with it, or what I would have liked to see them do, is explain a little bit more how the nation would have dwindled in unbelief, or some hint to why it was necessary. And I really thought they might do that in the film, and to see them, nope, they just, it is because I say it is.
One thing I thought was interesting is later on in the movie when Nephi's building the ship and the brothers come to him, you know, again, they're going to tie him up and kill him. And Laman throws this line in his face. He goes, "You told us that it's better for one man to perish than a whole nation to dwindle in unbelief, and we've decided it's better for you to perish than for us to have to go out and die in the sea."
Reasonable.
I thought that was really an interesting addition. That's not in the Book of Mormon, that Laman's throwing his own logic back at him. But I thought that was...
Yeah, and there again, it's just as reasonable, except that it sets up, but they're the bad guys, these are the good guys, and you God is with them because he says that he is, right?
Yeah.
They do have also that scene where I agree with Laman and Lemuel, yeah, about how this doesn't make sense. Why we go get the plates? Why do we need the plates? And they never answer that question either. A lot of people say, you know, this is really important, that they needed the brass plates because of whatever reason. And they also don't explain why that's critical to them having, you know, having the plates. They don't even flesh that in the film. But I found myself constantly agreeing with Laman and Lemuel that the only reason you say God is, or you say God is there, but you and dad are the only ones saying that. But where is the proof? And why should I believe it just because you say it so?
Well, they did see that angel, and that was an impressive scene.
Are you satisfied? Now we have lost everything. Our possessions, our inheritance, and the brass plates. You and Father and your visions. That's what I think of your visions. Oh, the Lord will provide a way, Laman. Well, where is God now, Nephi? Where is he?
You keep your voice down and he'll find us. It is over, Nephi. We are leaving.
No, we are not. We are going back to get the plates. The Lord will protect us. God doesn't care about us. He hasn't been protecting us. I have almost died twice because of your Lord.
No more, Laman!
Get away! Do you feel bad, Nephi? Do you? Where's your God now, Nephi? Where is he?
Stop it!
I will not go back and be killed by Laban. I would rather see you die first.
Why do ye smite your younger brother with a rod? Know ye not that the Lord hath chosen him ruler over thee? And this because of thy iniquities. Behold, ye shall go up to Jerusalem again, and the Lord will deliver Laban into your hands.
It's a miracle.
Patrick, take us through your interpretation or impression of the angel scene.
Oh, it would have been one of the best special effects seen on SNL on any given Saturday night. that's even for $1.5 or $2 million, they did not spend the money on actors. They did not spend the money on writers or directors, and considering he wrote, directed, and produced. They could have spent the money on special effects, costumes, you know, set design, something a little bit more impressive than that. And the special effects of angels and gods appearing is laughable.
Well, the original screenplay was written on actual golden plates. Oh, so a lot of the budget went to that.
Right. Well, it was kind of funny that the writers, the writing credits on IMDb, somebody was really effing with them, because the writing credits in alphabetical order: Craig Clyde, Gary Rogers, and Solomon Spaulding.
Oh, you've got to be kidding me. Oh.
No, I'm not kidding.
I thought it would be Nephi or something like that.
The writing credits, Solomon Spaulding's from his novel.
Oh, jeez.
Well, you know, we talked about production values and costumes, that he was kind of doomed from the beginning to do a period piece with all the, you know, anachronisms that exist in the Book of Mormon. So that's one problem. It's a period piece without any scientific support, right? And so you got the weird mix of, you know, Middle Eastern and Aztec-like costumes. You've got the bad scenery, because it is supposed to be a period piece, but that's not done well. And then the dialogue, which they'd almost would have been better off doing it in like subtitles or something. But you got the weird English, and you've got the King James Version English, and then every once in a while they say things like, "Let's get out of here," you know, and so there's this weird mix of kind of modern language, scripture language.
My favorite line along those lines is when one of the daughters says to the mother, "Mom, you're so old-fashioned." Or she goes, "We're going to a new world. You're so old-fashioned." And she's like, wow, that just doesn't fit next to the other
that wouldn't make
language. Made me laugh.
Well, actually, you brought up two different things, Matthew. One's the language. The other one is the costumes. And actually, the lady who was in charge of costume design was on the extras, the section called Creating 600 BC. Mm-hmm. And she mentioned something I thought was fascinating. She said she had this kind of dilemma because she knows her core audience is Mormons, and they've seen those damn pictures with the Schwarzenegger guys all these years. And she's like, I know that if I depart from that too much, it's going to be a shock to their system. So she was trying to walk that middle line between what people, Mormons, have seen in those awful pictures and what's actually authentic to archaeology.
And what we're talking about is that the Book of Mormon itself, there was a printing of it that was pretty widely distributed, at least among Mormons, of course, that has a series of pictures drawn out by Arnold Freiberg, is that how you say his name? Who incidentally did a lot of pictures for the film The Ten Commandments. So, of course, Gary Rogers has a connection there. But more to the point, there is no other source material through which an artistic person could bring this to life in terms of costumes and how people looked at that time. And all Mormons are used to these five or six pictures that were inserted in copies of the Book of Mormon that were just kind of one dude's, you know, interpretation of how this could have looked, but wasn't based on historical record or any actual research. So the whole movie's costume design is like through third party eyes that just kind of spun it up out of his own vision, which is kind of weird.
Well, and the one scene that is taken from there that was my favorite scene for a lot of reasons, it just cracked me up, was the shocking scene where Nephi is holding out his hand just like he is in that picture. And anyone who's had those, you know, a copy of that Book of Mormon knows exactly what I'm talking about. You know, he's shirtless and and rippling, and but he shocks the brothers, and how they do that again is just, it's bad special effects and just weird and awkward and out of place, and it's just weird.
I also know that you still don't believe that I speak for the Lord. I'm sorry I must do this thing, brothers. The Lord has commanded that I stretch forth my hand and shock you. To prove to you that the Lord is God and that his power is with me. In the name of the Lord, the God of Israel, I command that you feel his power.
Yeah, weird's the word. That's for sure.
The other scene that I thought was also weird is there was on the boat, and this is right before they tie up Nephi again, and the storm comes in. But Laman's wife is like dancing around and being all kind of showing some skin.
Nephi, if you'd only join us.
Get dressed. She's my wife. She'll dress as she pleases.
Layman's kind of like, wait a minute, my wife can be as whorish as she wants. Why are you telling her to cover up? It's just just very weird.
Yeah, you know, you read the story, you grow up hearing the story about this wanton behavior on the ship, and then you see this and you're like, oh, these are all like their brother-in-laws and sister-in-laws. And
yeah.
That's kind of weird.
Well, it's not just that. It's like, man, this isn't even up to Sears catalog quality. What kind of...
Yeah,
give me some Victoria's Secret, man.
Seriously.
There's part of the storytelling that was tedious to me. It had to be uber tedious to Patrick, I would think, and any non-Mormon watching this, was that like everything would be going okay, and all of a sudden, Layman's pissed again for no reason. That happened over and over and over. Was that as tedious to everyone else as it was to me?
I don't know. Well, I was kind of pissed at Nephi from the beginning, so I was sort of like,
"Well, you know, being, you know, seeing this for the first time or hearing it for the first time, I do agree with you that it was like, you know, he's pissed, he gets shocked, or he sees an angel, or something happens, and then he's all on board for a little bit, and it's like 3 or 4 months, 3 or 4 years later, whatever it may be, and suddenly he's pissed again, whether it's on the ship or whether it's over in the New World or whatnot. It just." Yeah, I agree with you. It got a little irritating. It's that, you know, maybe, and not being, once again, familiar, what comes after this is the conflict. And that was another thing I thought was the fault of this, is you're leading up to this conflict between the two, and you don't finish it. You don't have that point. You don't end the film with that resolution. You continue, leave it for part two, which apparently is never going to come.
Well, it's actually resolved in part nine.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Spoiler alert, Layman wins.
Yeah. The Nephites all get wiped out. Yeah.
I'd have to wait 9 parts to see that. Oh my god.
It takes 1,000 years, but Layman ends up winning.
Well, remember, Patrick, they have to explain why all of the Native Americans are darkies. You know, they're cursed.
Well, let's talk about that scene, the very end scene.
Yeah, and this is another area where the filmmakers took some liberties, because you've got Nephi and Sam. They've already taken their people and separated from the Lamanites. 30 years has gone by, and they're having this discussion, this gray-bearded discussion. And
so, again, the beards are – I mean, costumes are just horrible.
And Sam says, I'm going to go back. because I just need to see them again. I just need to know that my brothers are still alive. And Nephi says, no, it's not a good idea. No, I just need to go. And so he goes on this epic journey, and they spend like 5 minutes showing him walk, you know, like trek across South
America.
Like
he's going to Mordor or something.
And like at one point, they've got this great aerial view. They're looking down on him, and as he's walking, he like trips and stumbles, and then he reaches down to adjust his shoe. And I'm like, why did they just reshoot that? But they kept it in. I thought it was funny. So he goes back, and he's there at night, and he sees Laman and Lemuel and some of the sons of Ishmael dancing around a campfire, and they're just, I mean, they're wild now. They're like, and you can tell they're wild because their eyes are big and they're stretching their arms really weird and in strange. I don't know what they're doing. You know, they're like dancing.
It's almost like a
fire.
War dance, right? It's like
okay.
I mean, that's what it looks like. Yeah. It's kind of trying to take it as a Native American war party or something.
Yeah, from somebody who learned about those things from watching Disney's version of Peter Pan.
Right, Gilligan's Island. Or
yeah,
something.
It does. It's very Gilligan's Island-ish. Yes, that's it. And then he has a discussion with Layman's wife. Is it?
Who goes?
She goes, oh, I recognize you, Sam. And oh, tell my mother that I miss her. And you know.
And you've got to get out of here because they're crazy and they're coming and they're coming after you.
They're not your brothers anymore. They're different people than they were. They just they thirst for blood, and so then
and again, no development as to what caused them to devolve that way. It's
not in the book either.
No,
not really.
Well, I mean, in the book, it's because they turned away from the righteous traditions of their fathers, and so anybody familiar with the book will know that's why.
But it's kind of a throwaway. Like, I mean, let's just have Patrick pretend like he's read that section of the book. So you're reading this book, and all of a sudden, because they threw away the traditions of their fathers, they're doing war dances around a fire. Are you satisfied with that story progression?
No, it was an abrupt change in characters because they turned away from the traditions of their fathers throughout the entire film. I mean, everything about they turned away from those traditions, and they didn't become bloodthirsty where, okay, now it's 30 years has passed and I got to kill some brothers. That's what I got to do. You know, it made no sense. It was, you know, I was wondering if at some point they're going to explain this transition or this abrupt character change other than I'm just supposed to assume that, oh, because they didn't fall, you know, Nephi that now they've turned to the dark side, for a lack of a better read.
Well, and quite literally turning to the dark side, because in the Book of Mormon itself, this is when it's explained that God changed their skin color. So where once they were white and delightsome, now they've become. Does somebody have it? They want to read it? I don't know.
You mean the actual verse from?
Yeah, the actual verse from the Book of Mormon. But so they're changed so that they're no longer enticing to Nephi's people, so they won't intermingle and intermarry because God curses them.
Okay, right? So their skin gets darker?
Oh, yeah, overnight. Okay. And
that does seem a little bit racist?
Yes, a tad.
Sorry, a scotch. I'm just like listening to Patrick's mind spin around this. He's like, so...
Okay, when you're reading this, it's children. Do you not see that the point that their skin gets darker and they are so that they would not be appealing to Nephi's people who are the lighter skinned? That just to me that just screams racism right there.
Yeah,
actually,
okay, as long as you're okay with it. That's,
hey, it's what God's doing, man. God's the one that's doing it. You know. So hey.
All right, 2 Nephi 5:21.
All right.
He had caused the cursing to come upon them, yea, even a sore cursing because of their iniquity. For behold, they had hardened their hearts against him, that they had become like unto a flint. Wherefore, as they were white and exceedingly fair and delightsome, that they might not be enticing unto my people, the Lord God did cause a skin of blackness to come upon them.
And I love it when, and this is just an aside, but when people say, oh, there's nothing that says that there was a skin of blackness, it's all metaphorical, so it's not racist. Yeah, whatever. But so in the movie, Sam goes back and explains to Nephi that they had become dark. I mean, they don't really clarify, and that's why I think you didn't quite get this, Patrick, because I think the filmmakers were a little ashamed to highlight this point. So the scene where you see the Lamanites for the first time as Lamanites. They're dancing around a fire. It's at night. They've got all of this war paint makeup on, so you can't really tell, is it skin black or is it just makeup? And when Sam explains it to Nephi, he says that there was a darkness around them or something that you don't quite get it as clearly in the movie as you do in the Book of Mormon itself.
Did you see them? How are they? What did they say?
I saw them. They did not see me. Nephi, I looked right at them and I didn't know who they were. They were nearly naked. Their bodies were dark. Their whole countenance was dark. They looked more like animals than men. They had blood in their eyes.
The Lord told me this would happen. I see now it's true.
Well, he kind of said there's a darkness is kind of how he said it, as if it was kind of an aura or like you said, a character, not a skin of blackness. Yeah. And my wife was in during that scene, and Sam comes to Nephi and he says, they're like animals. And she just turned around. She turned real quickly and said, did he just call them animals? That's racist. Because she, understanding the context, found that really offensive. But he was trying to just say, I think their behavior. He was really trying to toe that line of not being offensive and not saying what the Book of Mormon really does say.
Yeah.
And you know, to be fair, this is Native American racism, not black racism. And somehow right. Mormons are more comfortable with that. I don't know why. But.
Oh. Well,
I was actually spent 6 months on a reservation, and I hated if that verse ever got brought up. But my spin was always, well, you know, it was a curse to the people at the time. But now this dark skin is a blessing, because if you overcome being born with that dark skin and become righteous, then you're even more blessed than a white person, if someone is born white. I mean, this church twisted my mind into being just a racist. Yeah.
Welcome to Kool-Aidville, population U.
Yeah, it's good to live in the ghetto, because when you become a millionaire, it's that much better. It's
right.
Awesome. Yeah, totally.
There was interesting. We should maybe link to this. There's this one reviewer who's Mormon. His name's Eric Snyder, and says at the very beginning, I believe in the Book of Mormon. I think it's true, and then he goes on and excoriates the film, and what's so interesting about it, and I'm not going to read probably any of it, but is that his critiques are not of the movie, right? It's not it's of the source material. He starts talking about how awkward the Laban killing scene is, and again, you can't just attribute that to the film. He talks about you know, the dialogue, and he talks about kind of the awkward way that the brothers react, Laman and Lemuel reacts. And I just find it really interesting that this is a believer who is able to finally critique and criticize the story that's told in the Book of Mormon, but do it in a way where he's saying, but I'm not criticizing the Book of Mormon, I'm criticizing the movie.
Well, and I didn't see that he was criticizing the Book of Mormon really when I read that. I thought that he did touch on the things that made the movie a bad movie. And I thought the way that he ended that review, this was neither a marvelous work nor a wonder, was you know, clever.
Well,
but
let me read one part that he says, and this is
sure.
I just thought, wow, this is really interesting. He says, he talks about killing Laban. He's unconscious, not an imminent threat. Why does Nephi have to kill him? Regarding the scripture, I have no problem with the notion that sometimes God may command a prophet to act contrary to orthodoxy. Seeing it portrayed in the film, though, it reminds me of the insane religious zealots who do heinous things because God told them to, and it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And again, that to me is, okay, I see how it's depicted there, but that is the source material, and that is the Book of Mormon.
And this is why Mormons hate this, because... And I don't understand how he can be comfortable in both spheres of his worldview of like, oh, yeah, when it's in a book, I totally get it. It makes sense if God wants, oh, it's in a movie? Holy crap, that's the worst thing I've ever. That reminds me of like zealots. It's like, dude, it's the same thing. Why does the medium change the appropriateness of it, and why it would or wouldn't make sense? That's the part that blows my mind of a Mormon interpreting it in two different ways at the same time. But
well, it's because when you see these stories... when you see an attempt to place these stories into a real world context, that's when you get the juxtaposition that, you know, fantasy doesn't really work in the real world. And, you know, I was watching this with my kids and really enjoying their reaction to it, really enjoying it. My 11-year-old daughter, you were watching the scene when Lehi comes out of his tent in the morning, and there's this little curious box, just somebody left in front of his tent, and he opens it up, and there's this brass ball, the Liahona, that he picks up, and says, and she looked at that, and she goes, "That seems really weird, Dad. Yeah, I don't think I really believe that." You know, she's like, who would have made that? Why would God make this thing and put it there instead of just telling him in his mind where to go? And so I took that as an opportunity to explain to her that, you know, Joseph Smith used a seer stone, and writers write what they know. So you would kind of expect a Liahona to be in the Book of Mormon. But that's probably a different discussion for another time.
No, that's good. That's very subversive. I like it.
Subversive.
but no, I think that is precisely why Mormons did not embrace this film, because it just highlighted the weirdness of the Book of Mormon and the story. And we do tell each other, and people earnestly believe that the Book of Mormon is a great book and is a great story. And so you would think it would translate on film, and to see it fall so flat, I think is a tough pill to swallow. So as a result, they say this film sucks. And yes, it sucks, but it sucks for a lot of reasons, including the story just does not, it's just not alive and is not interesting.
Is there anything good about it? Anything?
The film?
It was only 2 hours.
The original cut was 2 hours and 40 minutes, but.
Yeah, I can't think of anything that was good either about the film.
Is there, do you guys think, I'm asking the Mormons now because there's no way Patrick can answer this, but is there any way that Peter Jackson and $200 million could put lipstick on this pig, or is the source material just that two-dimensional and stilted?
Not by staying true to the material. If you took liberties and you fleshed out Laman and Lemuel and you had other things happening to show some motivation, and if you changed Nephi even and actually had an arc, so at the end he's somehow redeemed or there's something else going on, I think it could be an interesting story.
Really?
I don't know. I think I think the time setting and some of the special effects, if you had a reason for angels to appear and ships to cross oceans, that's about all that's salvageable from this story to turn into a film. Like, the rest of it would just be totally redone. All the in-between dialogue scenes, nothing could remain. And when I say nothing, I'm like 10% or less could stick around and not make it awful.
Because there's no villain. I mean, there's no real villain. There's no real conflict in the story that's driving it, except this relationship between Nephi and his brothers. And the reason they're bad is because they don't believe.
Even when they see an angel.
Doubt. Yeah.
2 seconds after the angel leaves.
So it's not like you've got orcs and Sauron and people that are really out to destroy you, until, kind of like Patrick alluded to, at the end they were building up to that. So now you've got some real enemies going on here that really are seeking out for your destruction. But, I mean, so to have a good movie, you've got to have some good conflict in it. And I just don't think this is enough.
Yeah. Again, you just don't flesh out why you like Nephi or why you hate or should distrust Laman and Lemuel, other than this is how it is. Everything is a given, and so that's why it's so bad.
So if you were to rank the annoyances of the characters in the movie, I mean, from most annoying to least annoying. And, you know, you've got God, Nephi,
stop
and Laman
it.
And Lemuel.
God.
Stop it.
Just asking. I mean, I'm a non-religious person. Patrick, how would you?
I found Nephi the most annoying character, even more than God. mainly because he had more screen time, and I was forced to watch him, you know. But, no,
fair
I...
enough.
As I said earlier, Laman is the character I probably relate to best in the entire film, and apparently he turns, you know, Native American, and that makes him evil. But
well, no, it just makes you not sexually attracted to him.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. That's fine.
But the acting's bad. We just accept that. But who's the best actor and who's the worst actor, do you guys think?
Laban was on the positive side of bad. Can I say it that way? I don't know.
Yeah.
He did a good Pontius Pilate in one of those church videos. What was that called? The Lamb of God. He was Pontius Pilate in the Lamb of God.
Oh, he was?
Yep.
Huh.
I actually thought the guy who played Lehi, Bryce Chamberlain, did an okay job. You know, that he walks that fine line of, you know, prophet and crazy, and you know, and that everybody's supposed to think he's crazy, and you've got to understand, is he really the kind of the drama to a certain point is he truly crazy? Is he really speaking to God? You know, you always know Nephi speaking to God, but you don't really see if, you know, in the film, if Lehi is. So it's that was kind of interesting. So,
well, kind of interesting. I thought Lehi and Ishmael were Jehovah and Lucifer in one of the original temple film where Gordon Jump was Peter. So some of you old folks might remember that. So I thought that was an interesting connection between those two.
That said, Mormons are quick to throw this under the bus, this whole production, regardless of any of those connections, because it was not, you know, endorsed or supported or correlated, or it had the church as an organizational structure had nothing to do with this. And every time I bring this movie up, not every time, but it feels like every time with active Mormons, they like to remind me of that. Like, this is a rogue production, even though it's by a bunch of believing people who, anyway.
Well, that's kind of interesting you bring that up, because that was something that I had read as well. And I was always, I had presumed that was why the Mormons didn't embrace this film. And from my perspective, and granted, ignorant it may be, you know, the Mormon church seems to be very secretive and about a lot of its teachings, a lot of, you know, practices in the temple and everything like that. To have a film made of what, you know, they base their religion on, even done by believers, is, you know, you're now going public with a lot of stuff. Not that the Book of Mormon is hard to come by and you can't the stories of this, but the fact that the church did not embrace it, did not support that, support this film, is that's what I saw as why this film wasn't successful.
You'd think that, but there are a number of other Mormon films that came out right before and right after this, which had much higher production value and Mormon support, or, you know, the way Mormons approached those movies was quite different. So I think that's part of it, but all Mormon cinema falls under that umbrella, and there's a lot of Mormon cinema that's widely acclaimed and actually supported by the majority, I'd say.
But is it a literal translation of the Book of Mormon, or is it?
Oh, no.
It's original work.
It's more original work, yeah.
And that's what I'm saying, is that you have Mormon cinema is one thing, but to say a literal translation of what, you know, is the basis of our religion,
right?
That's a little scarier. That's a little edgier, you know. And you know, the idea being that, you know, how you interpret this is how everyone's going to perceive us.
Well, it would be interesting if the church backed it and this was produced by the church or whatever, and they put it out. It would be interesting to see what the reaction would be, because it would have to be positive by at least the members.
I know it'd be playing at one mall in Utah forever.
Well, I think the church has dabbled a little bit into trying to recreate the Book of Mormon in seminary videos. Remember, there was Captain Moroni, a video in seminary videos where Captain Moroni takes on Zarahemla, the Lamanite.
I love that video.
General.
Yeah.
Right. Classic. And so, yeah, actually, there's another seminary video that's really funny, the Whole Armor of God, where they got like these ninja. These ninja Monty Python hybrids in the forest trying to get the Nephite warrior.
Yeah, that film gave me more angst and guilt about masturbation than anything else.
My point is that I think they got a taste of how hard it is to do, how hard it would be, how big of a project. I don't think the Mormon Church is ever going to touch doing what this guy tried to do.
No, and it's funny, you know, because I always thought we used to talk about rated R movies, right? And talk about, oh, you know, you're not supposed to watch rated R movies, especially when, you know, some of the period pieces would come out from Braveheart and Saving Private Ryan and those. And I used to tell people then, you know, well, if the Book of Mormon was a film, it would have to be rated R with all the war scenes and some of that. So it would be interesting to if they actually did it. But I think you're right. They never will touch it because the story does not translate to film. I mean, maybe Ammon. I don't know.
I think we've beaten this horse to death as it is. So let's wrap it up and go around the horn with any like final comments.
Who thinks it's a good film? Who thinks it's a bad film?
Sure. Well, come on. Haven't we established that?
Yeah. It does not stand the test of time.
No. And anybody have any final comments before we just pull the plug on this thing? Go ahead, Bob.
I have not seen a worse movie, and I wanted to challenge everyone here. Off the top of their head, what is the worst movie you've seen? Now, Patrick, you gave us one example, but you're a heathen, so you don't count.
This is up there with one of the worst things I've ever watched. And it's 2 hours long, man.
Yeah.
Worse than Star Wars Holiday Special?
No, man, that was yes. So that was great.
Yeah, the Star Wars Holiday Special was fantastic compared to this.
This holiday is yours. We celebrate a day.
Seriously.
Oh. You've seen the Holiday Special recently?
Yes, I love it.
Okay, let's edit that out. I don't know if Glenn's credibility is going to stick around.
Yeah, okay. We'll see what the editor says about that.
I just think that what adds to the awfulness of the movie is how seriously it took itself. It's one thing to be just a bad movie, like, an Adam Sandler movie where you don't care if you suck. But this movie just really took itself seriously and tried to be, you know, something very epic.
Right.
And it just fell flat on its face.
I mean, the very beginning where Moroni says, these words will be written down in the Book of Mormon. And then it goes, you know, and then this epic, you know, landscape, the 5-minute credits in the intro. Yeah, it was trying to be way too epic and serious. And then you pan in on these costumes that somebody made for a Ward Road show, and they're probably using the same props and sets.
You know what? It was a road show. It was a two-hour road show without music.
Yeah.
Well, and we have to talk about how it ended. It ends with Joseph Smith translating the Book of Mormon, the gold plates. Like, just like you're always told, he's going line by line through the plates, and he stops, he pauses, he looks up, after reading all the suffering that they've gone through, and there's a tear in his eye.
Yeah, but it's almost it's like a fade because it starts with Nephi's face and the tears in his eyes, and then it fades into Joseph Smith's face, you know, perfectly lined up, and the tears in his eyes, which I thought could be interpreted, if you're seeing it in any other context, as, oh, this is this person telling his story this way. So, like, Joseph Smith is Nephi. You know, it's almost like saying that in the end. But, of course, that's not what the filmmakers are trying to say. They're just trying to say he was so moved by this.
Yeah. That reminds me of that movie. Go ahead.
Sorry, do you think this would have worked as a spoof? Like, it was just complete tongue-in-cheek. You're just going for it and being basically mocking it.
But it is. I mean, that's exactly what it turned out to be. It's an unintentional spoof of itself. And, like, I've shown this to people, and they just – they laugh, even if they're believers.
You're saying that it would be a prime candidate for Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. My intent was to watch it at work with a bunch of non-Mormons and some guys who are pretty. they don't hold back, and I thought that would have been kind of funny to see what their reaction would have been. Maybe, see, that's what you do. It's the new Two Girls, One Cup. You just film people watching this and post that on YouTube, their reaction. Mormon. Oh, Glenn, one more thing. Did you want to talk about how it looks like the Matt and Trey The South Park guys might have watched this and used at least a portion of it for their inspiration to the Book of Mormon musical.
Yeah, maybe I'll juxtapose the I am Moroni.
My name is Moroni.
I am Moroni.
The all man. Because when Moroni appears to Joseph Smith, it sounds like that. And man, his costume is just so silly.
And does everyone in heaven talk like that? For behold,
right,
shall find planets buried in a. It's like, God, why can't you just talk in my language?
Why do you smite against your younger brothers?
So that's pretty great.
All right, guys.
Horrible movie. Awesome. Don't go see it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on and sharing the lunchtime movie review format and expertise to critique the Book of Mormon movie, Volume 1, The Journey. And we look forward to having you back when Volume 2 comes out.
Yeah, that's going to be great. I'm holding my breath right now.
Yeah.
You really expect I'm coming back, do you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, guys.
All right. Good night.
Night.
Night.